Good day and welcome to another exciting episode. They're all exciting, so I don't know why I say that, but another exciting episode of the OIG Roundtable. We got a little bit of a narrower group. It's Jason Eisengrind is not joining us today. He's got some well-deserved PTO, but I do have my two compadres, Matt Kachansky, retired senior leader from HHS OIG, and more recently, the retired UPIC Northeast director, and of course, Wade McFowell, retired ASAC assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office and a member of our SIU team. And I know it's spelled McFall, but I'm pronouncing it McFowell because I'm a New Yorker and this is how we do it. And I appreciate for the 20 years I've known you that you've never once corrected me. I know it's McFall, but you know, look, my last name is spelled Rubenstein, but it's pronounced Rubenstein. It's just kind of the way it is. So thanks guys again for joining for this weekly OIG roundtable. I think it's important. This is the first one of the year we're doing. And so with that, I want to make this a little bit of a Kreskin or Johnny Carson's character, Sarnak, the great Sarnak. I want us to, you know, think about what our predictions are for 2023. Now, first and foremost, you know, everybody talked in 2022, they were calling it, air quotes, the year of the audit. And I continued to berate people on the social medias and privately about why they called it the year of the audit. I thought that was a little disingenuous to say it. I don't mean that in a negative way, but I think it was just, I don't think it was really correct. I think that we're in a new state of affairs. The amount of fraud is really just becoming unbelievably pervasive. COVID did nothing to help that situation through things like the expansion of telemedicine and things of that sort, and the genetic testing and DME and all of these other schemes that are out there. The inappropriate use of G codes, the neurostimulators, all of that stuff that we can kind of say is just nonsense and snake oil. But at the end of the day, to call 2022 the year of the audit, that implies that in 2023, it's not going to be. I think that we're just in a new era. There's going to be an uptick. You've got federal agencies spending a lot more resources. I was on a call yesterday with VA OIG. They have an entire unit that they've now created that is dedicated to healthcare fraud in VA programs, right? So that's something that we didn't see before. VA OIG had been kind of tangentially involved in healthcare fraud. They have someone who came over from HHS OIG who is now an agent in charge, and her entire job is on the healthcare fraud, waste, and abuse side. They have an analyst who's doing analytics. They have a clinical auditor and the like. So we're seeing this expansion. We've got now also as a result of COVID, we've got the PRAC. I've mentioned them before in blogs and in podcasts, the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee. It's made up of about 21 different OIGs that are involved with fraud, waste, and abuse across the spectrum of fraud that came about as a result of COVID. So we're in a new era, and I just don't think that calling it 2022 the year of the audit. How about the fact that we're just in a new era of fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance enforcement, and whether that be audits or investigations coming out of MACs, out of UPICs, out of commercial SIUs, out of Medicaid plans and the like. So, you know, I think we're just in a different era. So I want to make that a level set because I just don't think that to call it the year of the audit is really appropriate because we're just in a new phase. So, Wade, I want to start with you. So you're focused right now on Medicaid-related matters for one of our SIU contracts. You're embedded with an SIU as part of a team working with one of the largest Medicaid plans in a Northeast state. And, you know, it's a very large plan. They have the most members in the particular state, which happens to be the most densely populated state in the country and has a very large number of Medicaid people. And you've now been there for a while and are working a fairly large caseload. Give me your predictions for 2023. What do you see as being some of the areas that are going to be the hotspot investigations?
Well, actually, my prediction is we're going to see more of the same generally. I don't think things are going to change that drastically, certainly not because it's a new year. Maybe things are starting to come out of the COVID kind of timeframe. COVID isn't gone yet, but the real hits of, you know, March of 2020, when a lot of things shut down because of the public health emergency, that's those types of things are, I think, beginning to be, you know, in the rearview mirror. But I do see a lot of stuff being the same. One of the areas that I see a lot of work in, and frankly, it's probably because there's a lot of work there, but it's kind of one of those low-lying fruit situations where during the public health emergency, and I've talked about this before, I don't want to always talk about the same thing, but I think this is important, that during the public health emergency, they came out with relaxed guidelines for like adult daycares, adult medical daycares, pediatric daycares, where during the public health emergency, again, starting about March, the middle of March 2020, the regulations were so lax that all the providers really had to do was, and the way the code was written, it's very, there's an interpretation and there's an exact, you know, line by line reading of it. But basically, in order to pay the daily per diem for these companies, you had to provide, you had to show proof of a telephone conversation where the provider talks to the member and basically checks in to make sure they're doing all right. Do they need anything? Do they, you know, have any issues that need to be addressed? So that's one, is a telephone call. Number two is the delivery of food or activities. They deliver meals to the members because that's normally what they provide at the daycare center. So telephone call or meals, or if there happens to be an in-person face-to-face contact, which was rare early in COVID, but that would also qualify for the payment of the daily per diem. So one of those three items, the way the statutes were written, you actually technically, if you read it with the lawyer mind, you have to do number one, number two, and number three. But we didn't interpret it that way because it just doesn't make sense that you're going to require someone to have an in-person meeting during COVID, and you have to have a telephone call to them to check up on them, and you have to deliver food. So there's been a lot of interpretations, but we really look at that as you need to do number one, two, or three. So if you do any one of those, you can bill for the per diem. And what we're seeing is people just got lazy. They didn't do one, two, or three in a lot of the situations. They billed the per diem 5 days a week, in generally speaking, throughout the COVID public health. They billed it every day of the week, but they didn't have any documentation. They usually delivered food one day a week. They maybe called one day a week. They rarely met face to face. So it was made very easy for them to be able to bill that per diem, but they just didn't do the work. They didn't, in most cases, they didn't make the phone call. They didn't make the delivery, and they certainly didn't sufficiently document it. So we've seen a lot of those cases. And again, now that we're getting away from that public health emergency time period, we'll probably see less of these, but that's still only 2-3 years ago. So it's certainly within, you know, statute that we can look at those things. So I feel like we'll still be getting some of those daycare cases that we're going to be working. And again, it's pretty basic. You ask for the medical records to support the claims and you just go line by line. And if there's no supporting documentation, it's an overpayment. So we'll continue to see those. The other main area that I think we're going to see is we do a lot of prepayment review. We see providers becoming an outlier where they're billing on a certain code increases, you know, 2-3, sometimes 800-900% over the last time period. So we basically send them a letter and say, anytime you bill this code, it's going to be denied until you can show medical records to back it up. So medical record documentation in comparison to the claims. And in a lot of these cases too, they just don't bother to do the work. It's the letters are very clear what they have to do in order to get paid, yet they just don't send in any records, and then we'll follow up. You know, we'll give them some time thinking it's going to take them a while to get up to speed, but we'll look at the claims we've gotten in. We might have 300 claims and they haven't sent in one medical record yet. So I think in that sense, I think we're probably getting to the point where we don't wait so long. We're going to call them and say, what don't you understand about this process? Because these claims are not going to get paid until we get the medical records. And And in some cases, they just decide it's not worth my effort. Some of the claims are very expensive. They're billing $3,000 for certain things. Some of them, it's like a $15, you know, you had talked about the G codes. They're billing annual alcohol screening, like mental health screening, depression screening, those types of things.
Smoking cessation training. Yeah,
exactly. And they bill that for every patient. Yep. I guess they can, because they want to make sure all those things are covered. But in some cases, they're billing it. That's supposed to be like an annual screening in most cases. Sometimes they're billing them almost monthly. And it's like, first of all, why are these patients being seen monthly? They may have some condition where they have to, but you can't bill those screenings monthly. So that's another very simple one where we ask for the records to support it, and they just don't have them. A lot of them are timed screenings, so it's, you know, between 5 and 15 minutes, and they just don't have the documentation. So those are two areas. I don't want to eat up all the time, but those are two areas that I think, again, lots part of it, the daycares are COVID related, and I think we're going to still see that for this year. We're going to work a lot of that. The prepayment review, it's kind of like a low-hanging fruit where if they're just not going to bother to submit supporting documentation, we'll consider that an overpayment. And then what we'll do is we'll go back and get a overpayment rate, a percentage. And a lot of times it's 100, sometimes it's maybe 70 or 80, but if it's 100% overpayment, we're going to go back 18 months prior to when we started the overpayment review. And we're going to, whatever that percentage is, we're going to request that back as an overpayment as well. So they can't just say, oh, it's not worth my trouble to submit these documents, because we're going to go back. So those are the main two things. We're still going to obviously see, we're seeing a lot of personal care services, home health issues where, again, people just aren't providing the services that they're billing for. And of course, you know, we're still seeing a lot of opioid overprescribing. That's something that we just, you know, that's something we have to look at just because of the nature of it. So those are really kind of the, I think, the four things that I've seen that I, but again, to take one of your sayings, Eric, the circus may change, or no, the circus stays the same, but it's the players that change, right? Did I get that right?
Right. So it's very close. The clowns, the circus never changes. It's new clowns that show up. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Yeah,
that's where I think we are.
Yeah, that's good points. I mean, you know, I think the thing that amazed me is when we talked about the adult social daycare, the adult medical daycare, about meeting all three points. One would think, so first of all, if you're delivering food every day, you actually could then meet the other criteria, meaning you drop off the food, and in the world of COVID, you drop off the food, you ring the bell, you step back from the door, the person opens the door, you have your physical check-in, so you've now met the criteria of a check-in in person versus telephonic. So you've met number two, delivering food, and number three, you've done an in-person check-in. You've actually can kill two birds at one stone if you're delivering the food, right? So you know, it boggles my mind on some of those. And then to parlay off of what you said about these recurring kind of things, my other favorite one is the advanced care planning, the code for advanced care planning. Like, how many times a year do you need to go over your DNR? You know, or your, and, you know, and I've seen this in some of the projects I've worked with law firms where an overpayment was assessed for advanced care planning. And I go through the medical records and I find that in a 6 month period, there are 4 advanced care planning claims or 5 out of 6 months, and the DNR continues to be updated. And it's like, look, you know, if you're not really doing anything of substance, you may run into a problem with this. Like, you need to, there's got to be something of substance on this, like, to make it so that it's not just a billable event. But, you know, I think you're right. The PCS, personal care services, are a huge issue. The home health and the hospice are going to be ongoing. You know, I was just on a podcast with a law firm out of LA a few weeks ago, and that was the topic. It was hospice and home health. And, you know, if Jason were here, you know, he would be talking about all of the trials and tribulations that he had at the Western UPIC, you know, where half of the hospices are located in Southern California, you know, to which I've always said, if you're going to die, I'd rather be dying in Southern California than I would in, you know, in the North Pole, you know, some cold location, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, maybe, you know, where it's a little bit chilly. So yeah, those are great predictions. I think you're right. I mean, I think that, you know, that's going to be the thing. The fact that the public health emergency is on its way out doesn't mean that the fraud is stopped. It's just now that the dust is settling. I think we're going to see prosecutions coming out from COVID for years to come. I think the PRAC is just getting warmed up with its data. I think OIGs are just getting warmed up with their data. Now that the HRSA program has shut down and the billions that were put out, I think we're going to start to see huge cases come out from the HRSA fraud. So Matt, I want to go to you. So yep. Northeast U pick, outside of, you know, doing that, now you're on our SIU team and working on projects with SIU's process improvement, you know, projects and all of that. You know, I know you've got a couple of things that stick in your craw. I know when I said neuromuscular stimulation, you have a robust head of hair. It stood up like the heat miser, because I know that that's something that sticks. I'm going to guess that that's one of your predictions, but let me send it over to you.
Yeah, just in general, I wanted to touch on some of the stuff that Wade talked about. You know, COVID, as you know, the physical impact may be waning a little bit. Who knows what's going to happen with that? But those regulations that have been, you know, tamped down because of the access to care issues during COVID, those restrictions are still not there. Even though COVID's waning, the restrictions are still not there, such as the restrictions on enrollment for DME companies, you know, where before they had to go through background checks and fingerprinting and all that. That's gone. That may never come back. So that opens up that area of fraud even larger. I mean, we saw it in the middle of COVID, where there were 4,000 new DME companies that enrolled in a very short amount of time, half of them in South Florida, and most of those owned by the same two or three people and had straw owners and all that. That's going to continue, because unless those restrictions are put back in place, it's opening that barn door. Another one would be the 3-day stays requirement before you go into a skilled nursing facility for Medicare. That restriction is gone. We saw some impact of that in the Northeast with a couple of nursing home chains that all of a sudden all of their residents in the nursing homes got switched to the skilled nursing facility, even though the level of care that they were receiving never changed. So we have to look for those types of things in the data, that taking advantage of those restrictions being removed in a time when maybe they need to be put back, or at least considered to be put back, because the access to care needs aren't the same as they were before. Another one would be, yeah, the device manufacturers, the neurostimulators, the e-boxes, all of that stuff, the P-stims. There's going to be stuff invented and patented, not approved yet, that you've got to stay on the cutting edge of looking at. What are the new devices coming out? How are they being marketed? What codes are they being used to be billed under? Because a lot of those things, A, they might not be covered, or they're not covered for certain diagnoses, and the manufacturers and the distributors are certainly marketing to the providers that, here, you buy this machine for X, here's how to bill it, and here's how to maximize your reimbursement. And that's going to go on for, you know, until it's stopped. And it's very difficult right. to stop it, because there's no administrative remedies against those companies. It's, you go against the providers, but they'll find right. other providers.
Right.
Specifically, you know, Wade talked about adult daycare. Yeah, that's right. You also have to look at the ancillary care that's being billed as going on there. You know, you've got the PT folks, the optometrists, the psych folks coming in, providing services.
Maybe. Podiatrists,
chiropractors. Acupuncture right. is covered now.
That's right.
That's another place to look at, you know, and it takes place in these institutional settings like adult daycare, ALFs, nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities. It's a captured audience. Those types right. of things are going to go on. And now, right. you know, with acupuncture being covered for certain diagnoses, that might be an area to look at for potential fraud. PCA fraud, I was going to mention that, you know, that's rampant in what we saw in DC, where PCAs were working for multiple home health agencies, you know, and billing each one for 15 hours a day and, yeah. you know, yeah. and not doing any of the time that, you know, but again, it's cooperation, pulling all of that right. data together, getting the home health agencies to work with you to give you their timesheets so you can put together a comprehensive report. But that's a big issue. And the last I'll talk about is, you know, behavioral health. You know, what I've seen in the cases I've been doing and what we saw in the Northeast is, again, people coming in, sometimes not the rendering physician, but they're bringing in social workers, they're bringing in other physician's assistants, providing care, but billing it as if it's getting, you know, 50 minutes of psychotherapy provided by a psychiatrist or a psychologist in the nursing home setting, in the ALF setting. You know, those things are just not happening. And but at least in the Northeast, in the state I'm from, Maryland, you know, they got rid of all the state hospitals, the mental health hospitals. So all of these patients are in nursing homes now, the Alzheimer's patients, the patients that need, you know, some sort of psychiatric care. Nursing homes are desperate for it. So these folks come in and they promise it, and, you know, they don't deliver what's needed. And it's, you know, it's a horrible situation. And yeah, it's something that we're going to see more and more of.
Yeah.
So those are some things I saw.
Yeah, those are great points. You know, I think when we start talking about some of these ancillary services that we're seeing in these settings, you know, podiatry, chiropractic, whatever it may be, optometry, you know, my biggest thing that I would see on cases that I would work like that, you know, I worked a whole bunch of podiatry fraud cases where the provider was going into like Section 8 low-income housing. And, you know, there people are getting nothing more than a pedicure. Copay waivers are kind of the norm, you know, because you've got that captive audience, as you said, is really an important piece of it. I think that these are all going to be huge areas to go on. You know, the biggest thing on the PCA services and the home health is what you really talked about is this data matching, right? You see these cases of these home health aides getting prosecuted for working 150 hours in a day, because the problem is that they're working for one organization and they're billing 12 hours, but they're really doing about 2 hours of work, you know, and maybe there's a kickback between them and the resident or whatever it may be, you know, their patient, and they're working for two or three places. And the biggest problem is this information sharing that just doesn't exist, right? So HHS is getting, you know, the OIG, CMS, the UPICs are getting Medicare and Medicaid data. You know, Medicare data is coming from something called the IDR. The Medicaid data comes in through something called TMSIS. And what we're not getting is data from Social Security on wage reporting, right? Now, granted, the wage reporting comes once a year through the W-2. It was easier when HHS and Social Security were together, and even after the early split, and remember, you guys remember this, we had access to what was known as the Detailed Earnings Query, or the DQI, right? We had access SADARs, to get in there.
Yeah.
SADARs, that's right. So the Social Security system we had access to, which we no longer, you know, did towards the end. But, you know, even when you had that, it wasn't like you were able to get like specific data where you could say, hey, this person, you know, what we would, you know, in the perfect world, if we knew, you know, home health company ABC, we would want to get, if we could, we get the, you know, all of the employment records for company ABC, which you could get. And then you'd want to run like the individual reports of all those people to say, hey, how is it that, you know, ABC Medical has hired Matt Kachansky, but then Matt Kachansky's name is appearing on 123 Medical and, you know, Triangle Medical and all these other companies. So that data matching is something that's an important piece of the puzzle. Data scientists, I think, would have a field day if they had the ability to cross match some of this data and normalize it and get it in. So for me, I see the telehealth issue is going to be huge. I just, I read, you know, there was an OEI study that was done, and I just listened to a podcast this morning from Erin Bliss, who's the assistant. I think she's the assistant inspector general, or she's the regional inspector general for OEI. I think she was out of Chicago, but, you know, she was on a podcast with the HCCA, and they did a study where they found 37 million people, Medicare beneficiaries, utilized telemedicine during the PHE, early days, I guess, of COVID 2021 or area 20 to 2021. Prior to that, it was only about 3 million because of the requirements on or originating site and the like, and 37 million, you know, used it. And I thought like to myself, well, that's great, but that's no revelation. The rules were relaxed. People were able to do it. You know, why wouldn't you do it? So. But I still think the big failure in our system is this cross data matching. How is it that we're still seeing instances of DME for Medicare beneficiaries with no prior relationship with the physician. And I get it that in the rule relaxing, you could do a telehealth visit, you didn't need to have a prior relationship. But if you're going to be, if Dr. Matt Kachansky is listed as their ordering physician for Eric Rubenstein's knee brace, why is there no E&M from Dr. Matt Kachansky? That is a very simple data analytics that you can run. Matt and Wade, our analytics tool does that, identifies no prior instance of that. Claims should be flagged immediately and denied if there's no prior visit. You know, how is it that you're ordering a piece of DME if you've never examined the patient in one way or another?
I can't tell you how many times we wrote white papers to CMS on that issue. And it always came back as it was too difficult to do because the provider has 18 months to submit their claim. So it could be that the claim for the DME comes in before the claim for the E&M. And we were like,
sure.
Yeah, maybe on the exception.
Maybe on the exception, but providers want to get paid.
Right.
The only instances I've ever seen of providers that waited to submit their claims were providers who were already doing nefarious behavior and wanted to spread out their claims to not be an outlier. It's the only time. I had a podiatry case years ago where he did that intentionally. He would spread his claims out over the course of a year. He would bill 6-8 months late. In some instances, he would do it after 12 months and take a reduced reimbursement rate just to not be an outlier for what was going on. So, you know, but we see that, and we see it. It's in genetic testing. Like, how is it that a genetic test is being ordered for a patient in which the provider has never seen the patient before? And more importantly, after the genetic test is done, there isn't a visit with the patient to go over the results because there's a code for that. Like, how is that even, you know, like, so we see that in mail order pharmacy. We see it in DME. We see it with the genetic testing. We're seeing it. So I think that, we're going to continue to see that the telemedicine is not going away. It's an important piece of access to care, right? It's a very important piece to access to care. I do think that we're going to start to see, as long as it stays, and I've said this many times, that I do think that the technology things of today are going to benefit the next generation, right? I mean, the Medicare population of today is just now starting to become technologically advanced. I look at my father, who's in his 80s, and whenever I have a FaceTime conversation with him, I'm speaking to the ceiling fan. Because of the way he's got the camera angled. Or, you know, even today, you know, he'll call me from his flip phone. He'll say, Eric, please call me back on the cell. And then when I call him, it goes right to voicemail. When I finally get a hold of him and I say, it went right to voicemail. And he said, yeah, well, I turned off my phone. I wanted to save the battery. Dad, you called me on your cell phone. So, you know, I think that, you know, as the Medicare population for the new generation's ages and becomes more technologically advanced, then I think telemedicine is going to be an even bigger problem than it is from a fraud, waste, abuse perspective. So I think we're going to continue to see that. I think we're going to continue to see these roundups. And I think lastly, opioids, which we didn't really address a lot. But yeah, we've got now two OIG or heat-related task forces. We've got the Appalachian, and we've got the New England task force out of Boston. I think we're going to see a lot more of that because I think as we start to get better at data analytics, I really think that there's going to be a better ability to data mine that with combinations of things like the PDMP.
Yeah, one thing to keep in mind with that is, you know, on a recent study that we did at Advise for an SIU, we looked at the top prescriptions for their payer, and it wasn't the oxycodones, it wasn't anything, it was the Suboxones, it was the things to help fight the opioid addiction. So that might be the next area of fraud.
Yeah. Yeah, true story. You know, all of this. I mean, look, I think that, you know, as things come in waves, and Matt, just to, you know, kind of close this out as we run out of time, but the thing you talked about, which is the device manufacturers, you know, these devices that are FDA cleared, which I still don't quite understand what that means. But you know, you know, you get these all the time. We just recently did a self-disclosure with a provider whose entire fraud, not entire, but a good chunk of his fraud was he was using a device in which the manufacturer provided suggested coding guidance, which is not appropriate. Manufacturers shouldn't be doing it. Ultimately, the only people that say yay or nay is the MAC and CMS. And so I think we're going to continue to see these, but you know, it's a challenge because you don't know what is the advice being given by the manufacturer. You know, I worked on a bunch of cases at the OIG when I was an agent where providers were getting hit with problems based upon the fact that they said, well, I have this book that the manufacturer gave me that suggested these codes to bill. And I was just following what they were saying. And it's like, well, that's, you know, they're not the authority. And, you know, so sorry, but you're going to have to pay this money back. So, yeah, look, there's a lot of stuff. 2023 is going to be interesting. We're halfway through, maybe June or July, we're going to have another one of these check-ins and we're going to see our Kreskin Karnak predictions.
Oh, you got it right this time. Karnak.
I did.
Karnak. That's good. Karnak,
not Sarnak. Karnak. Sarnak, I think, was from like Star Trek or something like that. So, the great Karnak and our Kreskin one, or, you know, Penn and Teller, if you're a more modern fella. I think in 6 months time, I think we're going to sit down again and we'll see if our predictions, I mean, maybe these really aren't predictions because we're really going on what we know to be facts versus some things that we think are educated guesses. But as always, this is great information. I think, people are probably doing a lot of head shaking in agreement with, I think we're going to be seeing a lot of that stuff, but we're going to do a check-in 6 months. Let's see where we are on that. If things that we've talked about are really the things that we're continuing to see. So great start to the new year. It's a busy year here at Advise. Again, if you're not getting our newsletter, please let us know. Send us an email at hello@advisehealth.com. You can also find all of our podcasts, OIG Roundtable, our LinkedIn Live, OIG Files. You can find all of that on our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, search for Advise Health. You'll find our channel. You can subscribe to that. We look forward to seeing you again at our next one. In coming weeks, we're going to be starting to bring in a lot of special guests to talk about some very niche fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance issues. We're going to be talking about everything from the self-disclosure protocol. We're going to be talking about the trials and tribulations of trials and some successes that have come out both on the prosecution side with the government, but also we're going to be bringing on a special guest in a few weeks who's had a number of successes in beating the government on criminal prosecutions and has done very well in as a compliance officer. So we're going to see that, have a lot of lawyers on. It's really going to be an exciting and busy year here at Advise. As always, I want to thank my two compadres, Wade and Matt, for being part of the discussion. Great discussions as always, and we'll see you all on the next recording over here at the OIG Roundtable. Thanks again, everyone.
Thank you all.
Thank you.